Who wants to ask a question or come out with a little a thought or any input at all? Tia, stand up, if you don't mind, and say what your question is.
Okay. Well, it's kind of a lengthy question. In looking at grace and how we should love gracefully, how can you love someone gracefully, yet at the same time help them when they're in a destructive situation and can't see that they're in a destructive situation? How can you not condone their carrying on that path, yet at the same time love them, not from a distance in the sense that you don't care enough and it's just out of your control, you can't do it, so then you just back off, but how do you caringly love them while not being manipulative?
That's a wonderful question. Did you all hear the question? John, for some reason, I think this is your territory.
Sure, I'll try. I have some thoughts.
Stand up so it can be heard.
Tia, what a question. I mean, that's the question. And I think to the extent that you're close to the situation, you can do very little. The closer you are, the less you can do to help. But the more you will be able to pray rightly. And so always, I think the first thing is honest prayer on the person's behalf, true intercession. What the person needs is intervention, and it needs to be done. In fact, the best thing you could do would be to call up one of your friends and have that person call the cops on your loved one, so that intervention comes from the outside without any kind of knowledge of the particularities of the situation. This is how things work. And then your role is to come alongside the person in wake of the arrest. And, this is terrible what's happened. Well, we'll be here to support you through it as you face the consequences. That is what I would say do. You pray and then call someone else. Third party, the further removed the better, the more closely associated with the law in the first use civil sense, the better. Remind the library that the person has 500 books out and they're all overdue anonymously. And then when they say you're not going to believe what's happening, you say, oh my gosh, and you come alongside of them. The key is intervention. If it comes from a place of judgment, of a place of being better than, of a place of being above, you will not be able to maintain your relationship with that person after the fact. But if it comes from a third party from the outside who could care less about your story, your emotional state, your family dynamic, and yet also are capable of carrying much heavier consequences, I think that what you can do is come alongside of. Always you're dealing with a person who is bound and incapable of controlling themselves, of doing the thing they most need to do. And it's like a demon. And the thing you are intervening upon is not really the person, but you are driving a wedge between the demon and the soul of the person. And towards the demon, you can really have a policy of sort of no time for it. It's not the person talking, you know. So those are sort of my thoughts. But the reality is, have you watched the show Intervention? Well, it's on A&E. It's gone into a 9th season. It's also available for instant streaming on Netflix. It's an amazing show. Almost every intervention fails. And the truth of the matter is, usually the worst case scenario is the scenario that most involves trusting God. And I tend to think people have very little faith when it comes to loved ones. They really don't think God can do anything that they're not involved in. And that's the problem a lot of the time. And so I really think, I mean, let me just say this. Sometimes the best thing may be the tragedy. And usually attempts to avoid tragedy almost always don't work. And faith, I believe, forces us to face tragedy without trying to control God. And so that's just another thought about that one. But that means, in effect, sometimes the best thing for the real alcoholic, and I'm quoting a person who I heard speak who had a brother who died of alcoholism. He said, "The best thing for my brother was to die." Now that's the final implication of what I'm talking about. That's as heavy as it gets, but our faith can handle even that. And so I'm willing to push it all the way if need be. And almost always, when the collapse happens, everything gets better. And so I would say force the collapse as soon as possible using outside third parties in the quickest, foul-sweeping kind of way. You know. Anyway, those are my thoughts.
And that's a million-dollar answer. That's almost, I almost sort of hate you when you say that, because that is so profound and so major. It's very similar to the mystery that surrounds Abraham's sacrifice of his son Isaac. And you're really there in the Holocaust there. And so I'll have to, let's really dwell on that particular response. I feel we're almost in the presence of something like Job. John is a person who has generations now of sufferers whom he has helped. Everywhere I see him working, he's always got five or six really, really troubled people following him around like the Piper. And so you speak with authority, but extreme gravity. What? Ike.
Sorry? Yeah, a contribution, please.
I would say that it's all about discipline, because in the Bible it says, spare the rod and spoil the child. And beware of my brother. If I do anything wrong, my dad would get spanked me all the time.
What, your dad would what to you all the time?
Spanking.
Yeah, discipline.
They have a rod, like, if you do anything wrong again, they're going to whip you. And when you're about to do that again, you're going to remember the rod. And you're going to stop it. So, I mean, that went through a lot in my life, so. I mean, they really disciplined me well, become a good child like this. So,
yes.
It's all about spending the rod and spoiling the child.
So what are you saying? I'm
saying if they do something wrong, you can actually, like, talk to them. You can, like, just, like, call them and sit them down and tell them this is what you're doing is wrong, and it will affect you in your future.
Yes.
Like that. And if they continue to do that, you can as well. I mean,
Right.
This is not necessarily good thing. Then after that, they're going to realize that, you know, what we're doing is wrong, and we're going to stop doing it. Something like that.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thoughtful contribution.
Anybody, I really am not into discipline, and I just don't believe in it, really. But I totally hear, and that's so lame. I completely understand what you're saying, so I'm sort of at a loss.
Can I just share with you?
That's why, Jeff, or you, yeah. give us a Christian rationale for corporal punishment.
There's a line. Do you know the psychologist B.F. Skinner, behavioral psychology? He's South Carolinian, and he said famously, and Ike, I think this is something to think about. He said, the only difference between men and rats is that rats learn from their mistakes. Now, you have to weigh the question of discipline with the reality of Skinner's statement, I think. And I personally think, as a Christian, that the law does the disciplining, and God subsumes the wrath of the law in such a way that when discipline descends, you are always in the most loving position with the person you care about if you can stand alongside of them and actually say, I remember when Dorothy Martin, she's one of the speakers from the Mockingbird Conference a few years ago, a child psychologist, and a guy said, my daughter wants to dress like a homeless person every day, and she's 3. And Dorothy sort of said, so what's the problem? But then she said, If you have to have, if your daughter wants peanut butter and jelly, and that's not on the menu tonight, then say it like this. Don't say, no, I am your mother, and you cannot have peanut butter and jelly, and I call the shots. She said, say it like this. It's so unfortunate. There's no peanut butter and jelly on the menu this evening. We're all just going to have to suffer through spaghetti together. And you see what I've just done? I've come alongside of the person, non-judgmentally, under the law, instead of standing over them, knowing better as the authoritarian. Because this one is the one that chases the kids to Oregon. Or iBanking. That's my thought.
Well, I would like to also add, and you have to comment whenever you're ready, Jeff. The issue that gets constantly raised is parents disciplining their children when we talk about this, because people always come at me and say, you know, are you saying we shouldn't discipline our children? And it's just that's where the rubber hits the road. First, Jeff, then Drew, then Kim.
You want me to comment on this issue of discipline?
If you have anything helpful to say, I'm sure you have something much better than I have.
I have an 8-year-old. Of course I have something useful to say. It is in us, it is hardwired into us that we should discipline, we should lecture, we must do these things. And it's in the Old Testament. Teach a child in the way that he should go, right? But, the world is going to teach him or her deeper lessons than you ever can with a lecture. And the most important thing you can do is just what John was talking about. Come alongside him or her when life teaches that lesson. That's way far more valuable than anything that you can say to them and saying, just don't do that, just try harder, just do this or that. That's my contribution.
John, you take over now. And listen to what Drew, who has 7 children, has to say.
Drew, I mean, I just want to say, I personally believe that faith treats God like God is real, and like God is an active agent working in the world. I think that prayer about we are his only hands and feet has very little faith in it. God works apart from human hands and feet most of the time. That's the point of the cross. And he has his own hands, thank you very much. And I think better to pray and do nothing, pray rather than say something, than to attempt to be God's hands and feet. And I will be very surprised if God does not hear your prayer and in some way respond, or at least in some way help you to know that he has heard you. So maybe that's radical, but I really think if we gave God a little more space to do his thing and worried a little less about being the ones to carry it out, we would actually find that life would be so much more full of creativity and, you know, just fruit. So that's another 2 cents.
John,
any other comments, response? Who?
The next question from Drew.
Drew, yes.
Just a quick comment. You mentioned the curious case of the coach mentor that holds such an important role in the lives of so many young men, and the best coaches and the ones that we remember, you know, 40 years later, somehow draw discipline out of a young man. But it has at a deeper level. They're expressing love, but it's not soft. Mm. So I think there's a role that a father can play that's different. It's not disciplining, but it is in there with the hard stuff with the son. I'm thinking about sons in particular. That is different from just being authoritarian. And that's what I would like to figure out. But there's something about that. And I know because it was true in my life that the coach can hold a role that's very different. I thought about an intervention because I had a coach intervene in my life. And, that's what was needed. But it was about love, not about discipline.
I think the show Friday Night Lights, if you haven't seen it, is really worth watching. because of the way it deals with this question. And it's all about a coach and his wife, who's a social worker or a high school guidance counselor. And all day long, they deal with children who are in trouble. And through love that often has a kind of stern face, amazing things happen. I do think, though, that the most important ingredient is affirmation, and that when you feel affirmed, you act more rightly. So I will just say that, too. And parents are in the unique position to rescue and affirm children, especially same-sex parents of daughters with moms, sons with fathers. Something about the affirmation of the father to the son has much more power than any kind of corrective exposure or lack of exposure will ever have. But Friday Night Lights and coaching and how that all works, and it's all there. It's a lengthy, extended meditation, and I don't really know the answer. But I just think a lot of like raising kids is like imputation, and I'm maybe naive. I'm on the other end, you know, but that's what I do with my dog. Oh, who's next? Yes, next. Matt, did you have your hand raised?
No.
Wrong.
Ken.
Ken, yes.
I have a question. Could it be that the reason that you three boys are in the ministry is because you belong to God and not to Paul?
Could the reason we're in the ministry be because we were...
You belong to God.
Belong to God and not to Paul.
Paul was supposed to raise you, but you belong to God.
Maybe so. I definitely think that it was when my mom finally got exhausted with me and asked, she didn't ask God to take over. She'd been doing that for a while. That didn't work. She ran out of options and was forced into the hands of God's whimsy, that everything changed with me. And now it's like my whole life, mom knew what I needed to do. And it was mostly from age 10 to 14, all I remember of mom, thank you notes, laundry. That's what I remember, mostly stress about figuring out the dinner. And when I became 19, after really just stopping paying attention to her completely for a while there, she suddenly became an incredibly wise woman in my eyes. And I would say things like, Mom, what do you think? Like, I hadn't heard from her in about 4 years. And suddenly, I actually wanted to know what she thought. I saw my mom not as my mother, but as a wise woman, a woman of deep faith and real trust and in God with her children. And I'd say, Mom, what do you think? And she would say, I'm sure you'll make the right decision. And she wouldn't tell me. It was like the moment I wanted to know what she thought. It was the exact moment she stopped telling me what she thought. And her relationship and confidence in God with her children increased ad infinitum. And now, you know, I call mom twice a week just to chat, just to catch up. And so there's just some of my own experience. Any other, who wants to chime in? Yes, Heather.
I just have a question, but if anyone else wants to chime in, go before me. But
how about a question?
Heather, you ask your question.
Okay. I would like for anyone who has some thoughts on just how to approach your prayer life with grace.
Sure.
How to approach your prayer life with grace. You two guys take over. You're, again, notice that we're all wearing blazers.
Jeff, what do you think?
We're all wearing blazers. Okay, well...
Jeff or John, either of you, talk about prayer life in relation to grace.
And in relation to blazers.
Prayer life and... Well, all I can reference in that is my own prayer life. And the only prayer that I can pray, that I can have absolute confidence will be fulfilled, is thy will be done. That's the only one that works. And ultimately, that's the only prayer that satisfies. And when you do that, I have found personally when I do that in my own personal prayer life, that things, maybe things don't change in my own life, But things change in my life view. Things in my life view become more graceful. And so that's what's worked for me.
No, I think it's actually time to finish.
I'll just say this. The only ingredient for prayer that I know is desperation. That's the only thing that fuels any of my virtue. Neil, do you have any thoughts, though? This is the man who painted this incredibly beautiful icon. Clearly, the portrait of a deep inner prayer life. And I just wonder if you have any thoughts about this.
About prayer?
About prayer and what charges you.
And I do more looking than I do speaking with God. And my prayer is usually, Lord, let me know you're with me today. That I seek God's presence. And things like God's will usually come from just being aware that God is always with me. I always look for Jesus in other people. And that's what showing yourself today. And if I can find Jesus, then I'm usually on the right track. Sounds so simplistic and awfully naive, but the more I grow in the faith, the more simple my prayers are, and they're less simplistic, if that makes any sense.
It makes so much sense. I just think prayer is trusting God to take the reins.
Remember those words the disciples said, we want to see Jesus. Show us Jesus. In fact, I'm always looking for Jesus.
Always looking for Jesus.
I see a lot of times. I use my eyes in prayer.
I think that's really insightful, using your eyes in prayer.
Well, I'd like to, we do need to go to our service of communion to conclude the conference. I want to say on behalf of the presenters a tremendous thank you to the rector and the staff of Christ Church Pensacola, including your deacon assistant and your wonderful staff in the education department and in the kitchen. Thank you most of all to Jeff Huell, who is really the guiding light of the whole inspiration. I thank Jenny Lee and her husband, who have been behind the scenes, giving us this wonderful backup and these fantastic meals and keeping us organized and in this beautiful facility. Thank you so much. Thank you to Mockingbird and remembering David Zoll, who is the director of Mockingbird, who is with a three-month-old baby in Charlottesville and has been texting us constantly and have been in constant touch. Most of all, thank you to all of you who've come. Spread the word spread the word to those who really can use this message, people that you know who really will be helped and inspired and encouraged and sort of rendered speechless by the odd mixture of journey and Martin Luther and St. Paul and addiction and suffering and love and breaking the fourth wall. Thank you all for coming, and I just will ask if we might. And now may the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ and the love of God and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with us all evermore. Amen.
5 minutes, we'll meet.
We'll just kind of take a break in place if anybody needs to go to the bathroom or anything like that. Just give us a... Yes, ma'am. Oh, can I say just a quick word about the New York conference? If you'll check the Mockingbird website, mockingbirdnyc.com, details are there.
What are the dates? It's March 31st, April 1st, and April 2nd.
Yes, and we call this a mini-conference and that just a conference because that involves two nights, a full day, and a morning. So it's a little bit longer format. Our speaker, our primary keynote speaker is Mark Golley, the editor of Christianity Today. So we've got an amazing speaker. And if you liked what you experienced here, the main thing I would like to share with you is, I don't know if you all noticed how different the atmosphere was at lunch today compared to lunch yesterday, those of you that were here when we ate in the garden. There's a transformation that happens at these conferences. It's more than just people becoming more comfortable with each other. It's people coming in contact with something. And what you felt at lunch today, if you felt what I felt, you feel at the New York conference, most especially the second evening that we gather for a meal. That evening is so wonderful. People stay well into the night because they really feel something. They sense something. And so I hope you'll consider joining us. It really is worth it, and it can be done inexpensively. If you'll get in contact with me, I've managed to do it twice now on a shoestring, and I can tell you how I do it. I'd be glad to. And I wanted to mention one more thing. John did not, I don't think you mentioned this, but you noticed him referring to a book. John and one of his associates actually authored one of the books that we're offering for sale, and it is a wonderful resource, Grace and Addiction. If you know anyone who is an addict, was an addict, or you were an addict yourself, you'll find much comfort in this. So why don't we take just, 5 minutes and let's get ourselves rearranged here.